I'm David Schreiner Khan, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Salim Ismail. Salim is a speaker, strategist, and entrepreneur specializing in breakthrough technologies and their impact on a variety of industries and society in general. He has spent the last 6 years building Singularity University as its founding executive director and is currently the global ambassador. Prior to that, Salim was a vice president at Yahoo, where he built and ran Brickhouse, Yahoo's internal incubator. His last company, Angstro, was sold to Google in August 2010. Salim founded or operated 7 early-stage companies, including PubSub Concepts, which laid some of the foundation for the real-time web. Salim has been featured in numerous media outlets, including the New York Times, Bloomberg Businessweek, Fortune, Forbes, Wired, Vogue, and the BBC. Salim advises Fortune 500 executives and many world governments on the future of technology and has recently released his first book, Exponential Organizations. Salim, welcome to the show. It's so great to have you on.
David, thanks for having me.
I wondered if you could start off by telling us a little bit about your background and why it is that you do what you do.
So I have a background in computing and physics, and I spent my early part of my career building large-scale computing architectures for Computer Sciences Corporation, which is a big systems integrator. And I spent 10 years in Europe doing half of that, half management consulting, restructuring large European companies, mostly which I'm bold. European companies don't like to be restructured. And I got into tech entrepreneurship, and then I joined Yahoo to try and make a big change in the world, and I thought a big company was a good vehicle for that. And I found that it's not. Big companies are so stuck in and difficult to turn around that I decided to go back to an environment that was more early stage and happened across Singularity University, complete chance. And we've been building that up for the last 6.5 years now. And my purpose is how do you literally transform global consciousness and global thinking? Because we're at the point of an inflection in the way we run the world, and we have to completely redo and re-architect the world.
Sounds like a big challenge.
It is not small, and all of our colleagues at Singularity, you know, here's the thesis of it. If you look at the pace and change in technology, we're seeing now accelerating technologies in synthetic biology and neuroscience and artificial intelligence, robotics, 3D printing, nanotech, even energy. And we've just never seen that before. One way I frame it is we had the Gutenberg moment in the 1500s, and the printing press changed everything. And it's like we're having 20 or 30 of those at the same time right now. Every single mechanism by which we run the world, our physics, our civics, our politics, our legal systems, healthcare, intellectual property, all need to be re-architected and map onto this new world.
So where do you start, and how do you keep it from imploding?
What we've given up on is trying to fix and update the status quo. If you take, say, education, it's too wired into teachers' unions, textbook publishers, ideological, you know, extremism to fix, regulatory structures, etc. We actually have to create new systems at the edges and let people gravitate to that over time. That's our current thing.
So that's your current thinking with regard to education?
Yeah, so we don't think we can update the existing systems across. It's not just healthcare, but it's intellectual property, it's our legal systems, it's our political systems, etc. Are all designed for a world a few hundred years ago, right? Not for the world of today. We think we need to update every single one of these societal constructs.
So talk to me a little bit more about how Singularity University as a concept is breaking through the old paradigms.
So, for example, the concept of a university, our current model is about 450 years old. It badly needs an upgrade. And we're in a pretty interesting time right now. If you are doing today a master's degree in one of the topics that we cover, like neuroscience or advanced robotics or biotech, by the time you finish your master's degree today, you're out of date. And we've literally never seen that before, that our ability to teach a subject can't keep pace with the changes in that subject area. So we need to architect completely new ways of dealing with that particular domain. And one of the interesting issues we have is, even though we have the leading researchers, scientists, thought leaders in the world coming to teach, we actually update our curriculum almost on a real-time basis to keep pace with this pace of change. Turns out we can't become an accredited, state-sanctioned university because to do that, you have to fix your curriculum and not change it.
That's an interesting roadblock.
It is, and it's a structural issue. It's the same thing in healthcare, for example. We're now getting to the point where the dosage of a drug is determined by your DNA profile and individualized in that sense, and we're getting to personalized medicine pretty quickly. Well, how do you do clinical trials if your sample size is one, right? And again, that's a structural issue.
So in terms of your thinking and what your colleagues are doing, either at Singularity University or elsewhere, how does this kind of change in thinking translate to people who are running small to mid-sized companies?
So for small to mid-sized companies, we think there's an incredible opportunity. We have in front of us the most extraordinary opportunity in the history of business if you're an entrepreneur or a small business owner, because the leverage that very fast-moving technology gives us today over the status quo is incredible. Large companies have a difficult time innovating quickly, and yet today we can move very fast. Small teams or small companies can move very fast, pick up some of these technologies, and go attack legacy areas with impunity. So the best example we have for this today is Elon Musk, who has no experience in the space business, the energy business, or the car business, and yet is leading transformative businesses in each of those areas and transforming each of those industries.
And what is he doing that is so different than anybody else?
Well, first of all, he has no risk gene in him at all. He doesn't consider that. There's a phenomenal story about how he made $100 million, $108 million from PayPal, invested 100 in one company, 70 in the second, 10 million in the third, and literally forgot to leave himself money to pay rent. That's a special kind of a person there.
Probably not your typical business owner.
What Elon is doing is going into new territory like space or cars or solar and using new principles or first principles and basically saying, okay, if you want to get from LA to San Francisco, how can you do it quickly without thinking about how do you improve the status quo? The California Transportation Department just authorized a $70 billion installation of a high-speed rail system between Sacramento, San Francisco, and LA, which is like 200-year-old technology. And he got so pissed off by that, he designed the Hyperloop system that would give you city to city in 20 minutes. And that's the kind of thinking we can now do with advanced technology.
That's pretty incredible. Let's go back to your story for a minute, because your thinking is so far ahead of most others in your space. I'm wondering, what have been some of your biggest challenges as you've been moving forward in your career?
Partly it's reeling back my thinking so that I can make sense to everybody around me. I've kind of been a little bit ahead of or further ahead of most people. The last 6 years, as I've been building out Singularity, I'm literally about the only person in the world who's heard all of our speakers for 6 years in a row. And so the intellectual kind of capacity that's given me by osmosis has been quite extraordinary. And part of the difficulty I have is, how do you communicate that back to the general administrator or politician or CEO?
Which actually is a challenge that lots of leaders have, because they have lots of knowledge and insight that others around them don't have. So how do you communicate that to people who don't share the same breadth and depth of knowledge that you have?
In many cases, I try and use anecdotes and stories wherever possible, right? This is a kind of our narratives. And there's a great, we have so many examples today of interesting things that it is becoming a lot easier. 2-3 years ago, when we would try and tell leaders that the world was fundamentally changing, it was a lot harder because we didn't have examples to point to. But today you can point to Elon Musk, you can point to Soylent, you can point to Jack Andreyka, and amazing kids and new startups doing extraordinary things. Airbnb, Uber, radically changing industries that they really have no right to shake up. And yet they're doing it. And so today the examples are there, and that makes our job a lot easier.
Which means that people are more open to hearing and learning about new ways of doing things.
They're open to it. The result is a little questionable. In one case, I told one major industry about massive changes happening, and the next thing they did was went and lobby for taxes against the newcomers. So the thinking doesn't always work the way you want it to, but certainly it gets a reaction.
Yeah, that's quite a reaction. Salim, what have been some of your biggest successes?
Definitely Singularity will probably be at the top of the list. It's been quite a ride to build that out. When we started, nobody had ever brought together a synthesis of, let's say, the top 100 scientists in the world and try and teach so many different subject areas in one spot, in one kind of course. And so that was a huge challenge, and it seems to have gone very well so far. The second was really publishing this book that I just released, which was kind of a hellish experience writing a book. It took 3 years and half of my soul with it. But that's worked out very well. Yahoo, although it ended up not working out, it was a hell of an experience, and I don't regret a minute of it. And I've had my ups and downs in entrepreneurship, as most other people have who've started companies.
And when you've been stuck, who has helped you smash the plateau?
So when I get stuck, I usually look towards, I do two things. The first thing I try and do is detox from whatever got me stuck. And then I try and come at it from a completely different perspective where I change the game completely. So I got stuck in entrepreneurship at one point, and one of my companies flamed out very badly. And I went and did a 10-day Buddhist meditation thing to detox from that. And then decided, let me try something completely different, and then got into the Yahoo thing.
Why do you think detoxing is so important?
Well, you know, we let's say you're building a business over several years. There's a lot of kind of psychological stress and intensity that you're having to deal with. And any business owner or startup CEO knows the pressure that they're under in constantly, not running out of money every week and so on. Dealing with investors and trying to navigate the market. But inherently, it's an irrational act. Nobody does entrepreneurship because for the money, the ROI is terrible if you look at it from that perspective. So after you've done that for a while and something works, even if it does succeed, you really need to take a break and undo the legacy of tightness that's put inside your psyche before you do something else. Otherwise, you bring a lot of old baggage into the next venture.
You know, I think that's actually a really important tip, and it's something that I see all the time. And I generally look at sort of two major impediments to greater success, especially when people have plateaued. And one is this emotional component that you're talking about, where you've got to make some changes in your mindset to be able to move forward. And that's in my mind, the first one you have to hit. And then the second one is to take the first step, because people dwell too much on what to do and when to do it and how to do it, and really you don't know until you try. So what you were talking about before with regard, as an example, to Elon Musk, having very little or no fear of risk, I find that people dwell a lot on the fear of either risk, too much failure, or too much success, and they just fail to take action. So this description you're going through about detoxing, I think, is a really important one.
I think it is, and I found that it really works for certainly works for me very, very well. And then the next thing I do is I change the game and kind of go for something really much bigger. And the metric I set for myself is, what could I do that's 10x bigger than what I just did, and what's the mindset that I need to go achieve that?
Do you find that you need help in having the mental energy to be able to go for something that's 10 times bigger than what you've just achieved?
it's really a mindset thing. I don't find I need help with the mental energy, because it doesn't take 10 times more mental energy. It just takes 10 times more ambition. The energy is about the same, right? We're living our lives with a certain amount of food intake and a certain amount of time to execute. But you can go for bigger and better at that level. And if it's, you know, if you're trying to start a company in startup land, if you're not trying to deliver a solution that's at least 10x better than the status quo, it's really not worth attempting, because there's too many, the cards are stacked against you.
There are a lot of impediments.
Yeah. And so you really want to go for something groundbreaking, which is something we've kind of tried to specialize in and get across at Singularity. We challenge all of our students to come up with an idea that would positively impact 1 billion people within 10 years. And to think in that way, you have to kind of leave behind all existing frameworks that got you there. And so that's our way of breaking the mold in that particular instance. And I've tried to adopt that for myself at the same level.
That's a great way to think about it. Are there questions?
Well, it goes back to the mindset of the legacy issue. What got you successful in the first whatever plateau that you've achieved is not the thing that will have you be successful at a 10x level, right? And so you have to kind of break the mold, go jump to that new model, and operate in that way. As long as you operate the process properly, then there's no reason why you can't do it. And there's a few magical examples of people that are doing that really, really well today, like Elon, or Peter Diamandis would be another one, Craig Venter would be a third, and so on.
And you mentioned earlier that one of the important components to be able to break through has to do with teams. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, no man is an island type of thing. You have to have a really good team around you and a supportive team. I have a set of personal kind of advisors and mentors. And whenever I do something, I ask them a question, what do they think about that? And they often give me fascinating advice. For example, when I was doing Yahoo, my previous venture had failed pretty spectacularly, and I was literally had no money. I'd pulled the kind of a mini Elon and not left myself any cash for my previous exit. I put everything I had into the new venture. And when I was about to join Yahoo, my net worth was about $5,000. And I had almost no money left. And one of my mentors, and I was hesitating on whether to join Yahoo or not, because it was a big company and do you really want to go work for, the man, et cetera, et cetera. And one of my mentors said, look, are you an idiot or are you just stupid? You're running out of cash. Just shut up and take the job. Just don't get fired in your first month and you'll be fine, but just don't screw it up. And I took that advice.
And was it good advice?
Oh, it absolutely was, because I really had no alternative and I had no other pokers in the fire. So if I hadn't taken it at the time, it was a big six-figure thing with seven figures of stock options and whatnot. It was a big package as a vice president. It would have been foolhardy not to take it. But me and my mindset at the time was trying to think, well, do I really want to join this big company? And my kind of advisor said, pointed at me at the bank balance and said, get the hell into some level of reality. So listening to mentors and guides around what you should do next is a really, really critical part of that process.
What advice do you have for people to find good mentors? It's a question that comes up really often.
Sure. Who represents the energy of where you're trying to get to?
And so
it could be a great CEO, it could be a great board member. There are people that kind of have a particular bearing and a particular approach and that you can learn from. Who is that?
Do you find that people you've approached have been open to being mentors?
Yes, very much so. Because the inverse is also true. And I try and mentor as many people as I can, because I learn from them also, right? I see what they're doing and I kind of, it's a two-way street. A good mentoring relationship is always a two-way street, and that's very powerful for both sides if it works well.
Now, what about the success of teams that are working on something together?
So that's, the team building of something is always much more magical, and you can build a much bigger thing. It's taken a village to build Singularity out. No one person could have done it on their own. Peter Diamandis really provided the kind of the spiritual thrust and energy to start building it out. I brought a bit more of the practical organizational side of it, although my team is probably reeling as I say that. But everybody has a different component. And the key is, what are the kind of three or four skill sets that you can build together to go for it? And maybe the most binding quality that a team should have is friendship as they get started. Because you've got to have something that will take you through the really tough times. When everything looks really bleak and horrible, you can always go off and play a game of poker or something. And we found that repeatedly in successful teams that they were really, really good friends before they got into the venture together.
Have you seen friendships fall apart when ventures become stressful?
Oh, absolutely. It's a kind of a nonstop process. In fact, very rarely do they really stay that solid. But the really good ones, if it's successful, then people manage to stay together. So you look at PayPal, right? The six founders have all sorts of differences at an interpersonal level, but they kind of decided early on that, you know what, no matter what's going to happen or how much we hate each other or don't like our approach or don't like our style, let's make a commitment up front to stay friends. And that kind of perspective carried them through a lot of very rough times. And the alumni of that group have gone on to create some of the most extraordinary companies in the world today. And so I think there's a great lesson there.
But it sounds like they consciously discussed how difficult it might be to remain friends if the business didn't go so well.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. And they committed up front to kind of saying, let's make sure we try and maintain that perspective so that when you get into a tough time, you can always kind of take a step back and go, okay, let's change context and then interact as friends rather than CEO and CMO or something like that. And that gives you that relief valve.
Right, which means that it's important to work on the relationship separately from the business problem that you're trying to solve.
Absolutely critical. You need to put almost as much effort into that as you do the business itself, because in the end, that's those connections and the interconnections between people where ideas spark. It's the stuff between the gaps, the gap between the people that interesting things happen.
Do you think that the importance of the relationship and what happens in those gaps is even more important today with the rapid change in our world than it has ever been?
Yeah, it is actually, because it creates a context to kind of keep everybody bound together, right? We have this issue at Singularity where we bring people together from 40 different countries. They work on projects together, and it's very hard for them to stay as a team because they don't have that underlying context that they did before they came in. And so we found it harder to keep our teams together because of that reason. The ones that form really deep friendships are the ones that succeed very well, we found.
Interesting.
This, 7 years of kind of watching them go through their process.
Are there some tips that you can suggest to our listeners that help teams coalesce, particularly if they're from different countries, different cultures, different languages, different time zones, and they're not physically together much or at all?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things are, first, there are some really great processes for managing group decision-making, group binding. Get some help with that process up front so that everybody understands the process and where you are in it. That's really critical. And then have regular check-ins with that structure throughout the period. And the third would be to have a moderator or kind of an advisor or guide that you can go to when something becomes a little tense. And then that gives you a buffer and as I mentioned before, the kind of a relief valve.
And does that guide need to be somebody who's not a member of the team?
Yes, definitely. If you have a team member doing that, you end up in politics, right? But if you have an external party, and this is the role that a chairman of the board often forms, where they will navigate and help the management team of a company just manage themselves, because everybody's pointing at the same destination.
Are there particular qualities that one should look for in the person who is managing that team dynamic?
A great facilitator is the easiest, obvious one, and everybody should have respect for that individual, which you don't always get. But just by virtue of that role, you get, you know, it's like when a judge puts on a robe, they take on a different persona. And so when somebody wears that hat of being the moderator, then it's a different persona you're dealing with. And you can, everybody, as long as everybody respects that collectively, then you're in great shape.
Sounds easy, but I'm sure that it's not so easy.
No, it's very tricky. Human relationships are, you know, are pits of misery and despair in many cases. So trying to navigate them is sometimes. Also, what happens is, in a startup environment or a small team environment, you get a you especially in times of stress, when you bend a piece of wood, the cracks appear, right?
Right.
And so when you put people under pressure, their subconscious issues, childhood traumas, educational frailties, etc., all start to emerge, and you have to be able to deal with that and patch those in or unbend them as needed to resolve and keep the strength.
It's really fascinating. It's a whole fascinating area. Salim, are there some aspects of your current work that you would like to share that you haven't shared already as part of this interview?
One interesting one is, I'll give you a great statistic that we've seen. We do a program with Singularity University XPRIZE in Deloitte, where we bring together 80 CEOs from Fortune 500 companies for 4 days. Okay, and we do this every 6 months with them. And we do a four-day program with the C-suite of these big companies and give them 2 days of in-depth technology briefings and 2 days on what should they do and how do you organize for this new period of rapid change. And we ask these CEOs beforehand how aware were they of some of the breakthroughs that we're talking about. And 75% said little or zero awareness, as you might imagine. Half of the rest were probably exaggerating. At the end of the 4 days, we asked them, how big of an impact will these technologies have on your industries? And we gave them a 2x2, kind of 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 years on the x-axis and low, medium, high, or game-changing impact on the y-axis. And the statistic that came out of that blew our minds, 80% of these CEOs agreed that these technologies would have a game-changing impact on their industries within 2 years, okay? 100% within 5 years. And all of them had urgent action items when they got back to the office. That's the educational gap that we need to bridge, not just with leaders, but with society in general. Most people have very little awareness of the technologies that are coming down the pike. And when they do, there's this kind of, oh, heck moment, and I use the polite term. And so that's a fascinating thing that we've been looking at recently.
That's really exciting. What can we anticipate over the next year or two with Singularity University or with some of the work that you're doing?
I think what we're going to do is two things. From an SU perspective, we're trying to figure out how to scale the model. We're sold out. Our programs are sold out through the year, and we can't figure out how to navigate that scalability because in Silicon Valley, we have a critical mass of great thinkers across a lot of the subjects we teach, and replicating that in other places is not something we figured out how to do, yet the demand is there. We have 80 students every summer for our summer program, and we now have 5,000 applicants from 120 countries fighting over 80 slots. And so it's an incredibly difficult thing to scale, and we have to figure that out. The second thing is that we're looking at is how do we run some experiments with governments or with regions to figure out the future of some of these things. You know, you take a technology like, say, drones, right? Nobody knows the regulatory frameworks, communication protocols, safety standards that we need to bring into bear. And so we're talking to governments or cities and saying, why don't we deploy some of these projects, work out those standards with you, and then open source them for the rest of the world to use. And now you have some data evidence-based environment. The third thing I would add is we are really on the verge of seeing some unbelievable breakthroughs in technologies that's going to completely transform the planet. And we're really excited to see those come out. One example is I'm an advisor to a small company out of LA, and they have literally solved the superbug problem, antibiotic-resistant bacteria, for which we have no existing cure. And as a side effect, they can cure all allergies. So that's, you know, just a little nugget of magic that's coming out. And we see hundreds of these, and the potential of the aggregate potential will transform our world very positively.
Whoa. So lots of good things to come.
Very much so, if we can navigate the human spirit aspect of it.
Yeah, that's always the challenge. So speaking of human spirit, is there anyone that you haven't already mentioned who's doing remarkable work that you'd like to point out before we close the interview?
Ray Kurzweil is probably leading the charge on thinking about the future in really incredible ways. There are some. I'm really excited about the young generation of kids that are coming out and doing incredible things. I'll point out Rob Reinhart, who's the founder of Soylent, which is a meal supplement or meal replacement milkshake type of a thing, where he's concocted a perfect 100% complement of all the vitamins, nutrients, minerals, carbs, fats that a human being needs. People have now lived on this for like months at a time without intaking anything else, and they've lost a ton of weight and they're way healthier, et cetera, et cetera. And an incredible act, instead of patenting his formula and trying to earn money off it, he open sourced it and said anybody in the world should be able to take this and use it to deliver famine relief in a starvation zone or something like that, or a disaster zone. And I think I'm incredibly excited about the ethos and the spirit of the younger generation.
Fascinating. Salim, can you tell listeners how they can learn more about you?
Sure. Our website at Singularity is singularityu.org. The website for my book is exponentialorgs.com. And there's actually a survey on that people can use to diagnose how scalable their own organization is. And my Twitter handle is Salim Ismail, all one word.
Great. Do you want to just say one word about your book before we close?
Sure. I wrote this book over the last 3 years looking at a new breed of organization that is scaling 10 times faster than any of its peers in the same space. If you're Procter & Gamble, for example, it takes about 300 days to go from a new idea to product on a Walmart shelf. Quirky, which is one of these exponential organizations, does the same process, new idea to product on a Walmart shelf, in 29 days. And that's just unheard of. And we've now identified about 100 such organizations operating at this pace. And we think this is a totally new breed of organization. And if I can take a minute, I'll explain the economic thesis as to why these things are growing so fast.
Please do. Yeah.
So when you're running a business, you worry about managing cost of supply and you worry about managing cost of demand. And you try and optimize around both sides of that equation as fiercely as you can. What the internet did for the first time ever, it allowed us to drop our cost of demand exponentially, right? Referral marketing, online marketing. If you get a viral loop going, your acquisition costs go completely to zero, and that's kind of a magical thing. That happened with the internet. What's happened with these new, what I call exponential organizations, is they figured out how to drop the cost of supply exponentially. So Airbnb, the marginal cost of adding a hotel room to its inventory is almost zero. Same with Uber adding a car to its fleet. If you're Waze, the traffic application that piggybacks on your GPS, when you sign up as a user, you are demand and your supply. Now, if you have exponentially dropping costs of supply, the denominator goes away and your business explodes, which is why the market cap is so magical on some of these companies. And the question for legacy businesses is now going to be, how do you compete with a startup that has no marginal cost of supply when you have huge workforce or asset costs? And that's going to be kind of an interesting question to watch over the next few years.
It's a really great question. We'll keep an eye out for the answer. So, Salim, thank you so much for taking the time to join us today on Smashing the Plateau. My guest today has been Salim Ismail, the founding executive director and current global ambassador of Singularity University. Thank you again, Salim, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Smashing the Plateau, the podcast produced by 10 Strategic Partners. Be sure to visit our website at smashingtheplateau.com and join our email list to hear many more great interviews like this one. And if you like what you heard, please leave us a review on iTunes by going to smashingtheplateau.com/iTunes. I'm your host, David Schreiner-Kahn, and we'll be talking again soon.